KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
High in the low 40s.
Here's a little gift for you, Kenny. A beautiful red silk necktie.
Oh, thanks, Jack.
Isn't it pretty?
Gee, you know, this looks like the same tie I gave you last year.
Well, it is, and it's different.
Do you swear or affirm that the information on your application is true and correct? I can hear it printing now.
Human culture has grown up with these microflora, whether it's in cheese or wine or mead.
Coming up this hour on Weekday, Sarah Dickerman's going to talk about her restaurant recommendations. We're also going to get a radio retrospective on how the big stars of the 40s in radio played up Christmas time. You're Jack Benny there. And we start with King County Executive Dow Constantine. There he was issuing the first marriage license to same-sex couples. That was a big night.
It was fantastic. Thanks for having me. December 6th, we started at midnight at 12:01 a.m., and before that day was over, and our employees worked about 18 hours that day, we had issued well over 400 marriage licenses. It was very exciting. Our employees and a lot of volunteers chipped in to make it a great night, and I think everybody who was there was really impressed with how well things went.
I went down there, and we talked to people in line, in the pre-line, before they went into the heated, tented areas. People were very jovial. People were in good moods, and great stories.
Really great stories. I mean, people have been waiting not years but decades for the opportunity to have the same rights that all the rest of us have always had. And it was great because of the individual stories. It was also great because of the historic nature of the evening and the fact that even as there are all these problems in our country and world, occasionally things do get better. Occasionally history does move in the right direction. And everybody felt a part of it that night. It was my hat is really off to our county employees, both from the Department of Licensing and from other areas who volunteered to work. Everybody could see that they were enthusiastic to help the public in this fun event. And I have never heard so many positive comments from our public about the not just the efficiency, but the attitude of the public employees. People were genuinely excited.
Well, it was a night for that, that's for sure. Election results mean that Bob Ferguson is leaving the county council, so how do you choose a successor?
Yeah,
not you personally.
My former county council colleague, Bob Ferguson, was elected attorney general, and he'll take office in mid-January. So it falls to me and to the county council under state law to come up with a successor who will serve until next year's election. The formal process is for me to send three names to the county council, and then from the date of the vacancy, they have 60 days to choose one of those three people. And if they do not do so, then the governor has a month to choose from that same list. What I've done is set up a citizens committee, about 13 people, representative of the first district, which is kind of the northern tier of King County, including Shoreline. And they have taken the applications, the dozen applications we receive from prospective council members, and they're interviewing those folks. They're going over their qualifications. They're going to send me a list of recommendations, more than three, probably about a half dozen, of the most qualified people. And that is just a process I set up to make sure we had stakeholder input, community input. So once I get those, I will consider them. I may or may not individually interview the candidates, but then I'm going to provide a list to the county council so they can choose. It's a, you know, it's a great opportunity for someone to step up to leadership. A lot of the applicants are city council members. There's a state legislator on the list, but they still do have to stand for election in the fall. So, although it's you're running in a jurisdiction of nine council members, it won't be but a few months that you have to face, you know, 200,000 more citizens and ask for their support.
What impact does Bob Ferguson's departure have on the political makeup of this nonpartisan council?
So there are right now five nonpartisan Democrats and four nonpartisan Republicans on the county council. And with Bob's departure, the council will be evenly split, as it was when I left. You may recall that there was a prolonged period of uncertainty after I left because they could not agree on a successor. Eventually,
who was that?
It was Jan Drago, and she did not run. She was appointed as a placeholder. The legislature, after that, created some rules, created law for an appointment process where the executive actually recommends someone to the county council, and the county council has a deadline by which they need to act, or else the governor will act. So that will provide a little more focus and hopefully lead to agreement on the county council.
Jan Drago didn't run in part. That was how she ended up there, right? So
right.
That people, everybody agreed that it would be a contested
right.
seat.
And Joe McDermott was clearly the strongest candidate and was going to be for election. And he had asked to be appointed, and that didn't happen. So he then ran and won handily in the fall. It's my hope that whoever the council selects, it's going to be someone who will enjoy broad support in their district and will be a strong candidate in the fall.
So you want to see somebody who can be
yes.
up for election
yes.
or re-election?
I don't think that the additional transitions help the county council function. I think that you need somebody who can hit the ground running and that can build on their experience during their first year to be effective over the course of a full term.
Oh, so if they hit the ground running, that means you're going to want somebody who has some experience in the legislative process?
Or in public process generally. I think you want to make sure that you have somebody, and I think all of the applicants meet that sort of requirement. I think all of them have good, strong experience in public and private affairs.
Dow Constantine is the King County Executive. He joins us once a month to talk about issues. Take your phone calls at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. Now, of course, the big story this week and last was the shootings on the East Coast, raising questions about two things, mental health, but more about gun control. But the county doesn't have much impact in gun control issues, do you?
Yeah, the state really has occupied the field in the area of firearms. We have, at the county, only two powers. One is to create no shooting zones. So, and this really relates to hunting. You know, if we determine that guns cannot be discharged safely, then we can create a zone, or citizens can petition to have it created, where shooting is not allowed. And on the citizens can petition to have those zones dissolved as well. And then we can also regulate to an extent through our land use and zoning where guns can be sold in the county. Other than that, we don't have power to regulate firearms. And we do, however, have the power to lobby the state legislature. And I think that we are not going to be the only local government asking the state legislature to take a stronger stand on the availability of guns.
What would you like to see the legislature do? Changes would you like to see?
You know, I just personally believe, and I'm not the only one, obviously, that that the kind of weapons that have been used in these massacres are not the sorts of weapons that people need to defend themselves in their home if they, in fact, think they need a gun. They are designed solely for killing people in large numbers. And the fact that they're so readily available in our state and throughout our country means that we are all at great risk from people who are not mentally sound. And you can talk about our mental health system, and I'm happy to talk about that. But the fact is that it is a lethal combination, and we ought to have tighter control on the types of guns that can be sold, and particularly the way in which people who are not well-adjusted can come into possession of them.
You would like to see the loopholes closed in terms of background checks, in terms
yes.
of who's licensed to sell, and restrictions on some of the assault weapons and the magazines that
yes.
and this will come with that.
I mean, this has been discussed and rehashed so many times over the course of the last several days, it almost doesn't bear repeating, but there is absolutely no reason for someone like this shooter's mother to have multiple automatic type weapons in her home and have them available to somebody she knew was mentally ill. It's just absolutely unacceptable. And watching the debate with the apologists for this kind of policy, trying to explain that we'd all be safer if we were all armed to the teeth, has been surreal, I think. And clearly would not all be safer if there were even more of these kinds of weapons, because it just increases the chances they're going to fall into the hands of somebody like this guy.
In terms of mental health, that is one place where King County does have a budget. And I can do a Google search, King County mental health budget cuts, and I get 2011 budget cuts ripped through mental health safety net in state. 2009, state announces 2009 budget cuts in mental health. 2006, I mean, it goes
so
back.
The federal and state government, I mean, the federal government starting with Reagan and the state government more recently due to the inability to raise adequate revenue, have been backing away from our mental health work. The county has been trying to make up for this deficit, and a couple major examples are the mental illness and drug dependency tax adopted by the county council and the Veterans and Human Services levy approved twice now by the people of King County. But we are really unable to make up for the loss of that capacity from the federal and state level. And I think we have to have a conversation not just within Seattle and King County, which we are having, about the best way to approach this problem, but statewide, about our inability to step up to our responsibility. And I really believe that if we were to take a more systematic, client-centered, organized approach across the state, ultimately it would save not only lives, redeem lives of these people, but it would save money.
Explain your concept there.
Well, we need to move away from the model that we have used in the past for many things, homelessness or other human services, where we're simply funding individual organizations or individual programs, and move towards a systems approach where someone comes into the system, we have an analysis or a triage where we identify the right resource for that particular person, we adequately fund that resource, because people come to us with a whole range of challenges. What we have done is had these sort of haphazard cuts to the system. You may happen to walk in the right front door and fall into the right service that's going to help you, but it's also very likely that you will walk in the wrong front door, not get the service you need, and end up not getting ultimately back on track.
What are King County wraparound services? Mental health wraparound services.
What we try to do is, and this is the same approach we've taken to, say, homelessness, we try to get someone and provide them all the services they need to make genuine progress and get their life stabilized, rather than having them come in, be somewhere for a little while, send them out the door without any support. I believe, are making progress on homelessness, for example, by creating the Housing First model, where we get people with a roof over their head, and then we sit down with them and we identify whether they have a substance addiction problem, whether they have a mental health problem, and get them the specific help they need in order to start rebuilding their life. It is hard work. It's messy work. It's not something simple, and you got to be very systematic about it. And simply raising money and spending it on whatever existing program you have, and assuming that the number of dollars you put in the top equates to results coming out the other end, is not adequate.
Does your budget maintain or have cuts to mental health services in this biennium?
I think that our county budget maintained our commitment to mental health services largely because of the generosity of the voters of the county, who stepped up this last year and approved the mental illness, Veterans and Human Services levy. But this same story exists in a whole range of services or programs that used to be funded by the federal and state governments. We are trying desperately at the local level to maintain standards in transportation and safety in human services. And we don't have the resources to. We don't have the authority to even try to raise the resources.
Well, on that note, let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about the latest budget that the governor has put forth. This is Weekday.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of how assault weapons like the semi-automatic rifle that was used in the Newtown Massacre became available on the civilian market. We talk with Tom Diaz, senior policy analyst at the Violence Policy Center and author of the forthcoming book, The Last Gun. Join us.
And that comes your way tonight at 8 over on our second program service, KUOW2. Good morning, it's 10:20. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Earth Justice, a nonprofit law firm that believes a healthy environment is a fundamental right, working to restore native rivers so that they can flow freely. Earth Justice, the earth needs a good lawyer.
We have clouds and rain, 43 degrees in the University District. We're expecting rain the rest of today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, the low in the mid-30s. It's going to be cloudy and rainy again tomorrow, the high in the low 40s.
Dow Constantine is our guest. He's King County executive. We were talking before the break about mental health services and services in general. By the way, I just because I asked, I looked it up. So you have this wraparound service and a wraparound application, a centralized referral process through Mental Health, Chemical Abuse, Dependency Services Division, goes through the wraparound program specialist. Referrals will be prioritized based on need. I'm reading from the webpage. Due to limited capacity, there will be a wait list. So here is a program you think works, but you are limited by funding.
Yeah.
The governor has put forth a new fund, a new budget. What impact does it have on county funding from your perspective?
Well, again, this is Governor Gregoire's final proposed budget, and she's required to submit a budget that has a lot of constraints on it, which are absurd. We cannot maintain an adequate level of services in the state without additional resources.
I know, but you have a new governor who says we're not raising taxes.
Well, that is something they're going to have to work out in Olympia with the Republican Senate. But the Governor Gregoire's proposed budget eliminates the state food assistance program and other services for vulnerable people, the kind of services that county governments are charged with providing using state funds.
Do you know how many people that serves?
I do not, but it would be obviously really problematic for us to lose even more human services funding. And we cannot keep trying to piece together a system at the local level without the resources to do it. It also reduces levy equalization support for school districts by about $100 million and cuts the state colleges and universities by $50 million.
Well, this is her budget. This is her budget that she submits. And in a way, she is saying with this budget, this is what the revenue stream allows me. Here's how you have to think about, is this what you want, state legislature,
and
Governor Inslee?
And I think that it's a good question for her to pose. Now, she did propose a good start on dealing with the K-12 funding challenge, which is shifting student transportation to the state transportation budget and funding that with a diesel fuel or an excise tax on gasoline and diesel fuel. The strategy of the Senate Republicans in particular is to say, we can pay for education out of existing resources, and then you're just going to have to make cuts to everything else, even deeper cuts to everything else. Everything else has already been cut. Everything else has been cut very deeply. We've already talked about that this hour. At some point, people are going to have to step up and realize that funding both the physical and human infrastructure is foundational to our continued prosperity in this state. And if you keep cutting it, ultimately, you're cutting off your future.
I'm sure you've said that to Governor-elect Inslee.
I've said that to Governor-elect Inslee, to Governor Gregoire, and they both, I'm sure, fundamentally agree with that proposition. And I say it wherever I can and try to cite examples of the fact that our infrastructure that was handed to us by our parents and grandparents is being allowed to deteriorate, whether it's the colleges and universities or whether it's roads and bridges.
Do you think a Republican-run Senate, which is what we apparently are going to have with the two Democrats in the Roadkill Caucus, caucusing with the Republicans, have any inkling, any interest in making changes to the way they've been approaching the budget?
Well, being in the majority is different than being in the minority in this way. You are responsible for the results. When you're in the minority, you can take absurd, extreme ideological positions and take pot shots at the majority while they struggle to try to govern. They have now decided they want to be in the majority, the Republicans, including the two former Democrats. So they need to produce. They need to produce results. They can't act like they did when they were sitting on the sidelines.
But they can just do what you were saying.
And people will need to hold them to account.
You'll just see more budget cuts.
People will need to hold them to account. They are now responsible for those cuts.
You signed a memorandum of understanding with the city of Seattle on Third Avenue.
Oh, right? Third Avenue, right.
Right. I know I'm shifting. I'm jumping around.
I'm trying to follow you.
There was not a good transition there.
I listeners are trying to follow you.
I apologize. Let me shift topics to Third Avenue and the memorandum of understanding you signed with the city. What's wrong with Third Avenue?
Well, Third Avenue has had a lot of problems with crime and homelessness and just general disarray, if I may. And it's and part of the challenge is it's been when it was shifted to an all transit corridor, it really changed the clientele a lot. What we want to do in conjunction with the city and the Downtown Seattle Association, and the DSA has really been helping lead the charge on this, is to dramatically change the streetscape along Third Avenue. There are great transit corridors around the world where people have invested in appropriate street furniture, lighting, maintenance, technology, like the technology that allows you to know when the next bus is going to be there to take you to your destination, policing. And we can make Third Avenue that kind of a corridor.
What would it look like? What would be the appropriate changes if Third Avenue were to function well?
Well, what we're doing is coordinating on, first of all, planning a corridor from Pioneer Square all the way up to Denny, really. A coherent corridor that has street furniture that's designed to encourage positive interaction rather than the kind of, you know, feeling of danger that people sometimes have when
what is
certain
that?
Areas down.
When you say street furniture, what is that?
Street furniture can be bus stops, garbage cans, paper boxes, any of the things that occur outside of the front walls of the buildings. We also, one of the...
I thought you meant chairs and tables.
No, one of the... Well, maybe so. But one of the favored approaches, you know, here, obviously, we need overhead shelter. And we have these bus shelters, these little bus shelters, which are great to keep you dry, but they're also places where people can kind of hide out and it makes others feel unsafe. So one of the favored approaches is those high awnings that you see on newer downtown buildings. Encouraging that, not just on new buildings, but retrofitting either the sidewalk or the other buildings with those high awnings so that everyone is in the same space, there aren't little cubby holes with people hiding out, is one way to encourage both the feel and the reality of safety along the street. Lighting the buildings, not just, you know, bright spotlights, but actual attractive lighting that's warm and inviting along the facades of those buildings up and down the avenue, encourages a feeling of safety and changes the way people behave in that space. We already have a maintenance schedule where we pressure wash around our bus stops every single day at the end of the day. The city of Seattle comes through and maintains, the DSA does. We're going to increase that kind of maintenance to make sure that it's clean and tidy and orderly because that kind of approach encourages good behavior. In general, we are going to try to take this on over the long term to make sure that we encourage business, we encourage commuters, and we discourage the kinds of problems that a lot of our downtown visitors complain about. I will say one other thing. We're also coordinating back to Human Services on finding the right service for the people who end up downtown and in this corridor in particular. And we're going to coordinate with the City of Seattle and Human Service agencies to get them the help they need.
This is a tangential, but coordinating those services to help people get the service they need. Do you have the tools that you need when you find somebody who's obviously mentally unbalanced to make them accept services?
I'm not sure the extent of our legal authority to make someone accept services. If someone is picked up and they're able to be picked up because of criminal activity, for example, some kind of violation, they can be brought to a crisis center if they're clearly having a mental health challenge. For instance, the Downtown Emergency Service Center has established a crisis center in the south part of downtown where folks can be brought and they can get the kind of help they need. The kind of help they don't need is going and sitting in jail usually. And our jail is full of people who are really would more appropriately be in a mental health institution. But because those have been shut down, because they are being, including Western State, starved for money, we end up with a lot of folks in jail who are not being done any real good while they're there. And once they get out, none of their underlying problems have been dealt with.
Another tangential, and then I'm coming back to Third Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't this register? Why is it that we have seen countless newspaper series about the problems with mental health and services? Countless complaints by electeds that services have disappeared, institutions have been closed. I will ask this also of Republican leaders when they come in, but why do you think this doesn't register? I mean, it's not that we don't see folks, because everybody sees folks now who you know need help.
I think that it has registered with a lot of the elected officials. It, you know, we, again, have a partisan, nonpartisan county council, and I really think across the board, members recognize that dealing with the underlying problems is much more effective than dealing with the symptoms, including crime and violence and homelessness. And people like Kathy Lambert and Reagan Dunn and Jane Haig and Pete von Reichbauer have supported those approaches of increasing access to mental health treatment or to chemical dependency treatment. Getting the message out to the larger public is extremely difficult. It's unless people sit down and really think about it, it's just more taxes, and what they really want when they see a problem is for a cop to come and arrest somebody. But if we're putting all our money into that, you know, that end of the process, which is a failure, rather than into solving the problems, we're going to have increasing costs and increasing trouble over the years.
I would beg to say that that's, don't you think that simplifies the public's response? I mean, the public I know is a variety,
mm-hmm.
but don't you think by now people do understand that that we need to see services at the front end? Is it that legislators don't make the connection between the actual cost for the program and the tax we should pay?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, the voters of the state have elected a Republican Senate, and they don't want to raise revenue, even though raising revenue would allow them to fund the kind of programs that ultimately will save lives and save money. In King County, the voters voted to pay out of their pockets for some of those services that are no longer being provided by the state and federal government. I think our electorate here does get it. I think that people need to get past the right-wing anti-tax rhetoric and think about the consequences for their lives, their families' lives, and their community of failing to fund these services. And then that understanding needs to be reflected in their votes at the ballot, both for ballot measures and for their elected representative.
Do people in King County, does Dow Constantine need to go to, and I'm just randomly naming counties, on the east side counties or up to Skagit or anywhere and make that case, go to the hostile crowds and make that case?
We do need to operate more as a state. I think that we have a pretty good understanding here locally among our voters, but we do need to work with others across the state who have a tougher political climate on helping them and their constituents understand what's at stake. I do have a chance occasionally to go to other parts of the state and work with them on important programs, not directly related, but still critical. I was in Spokane to work on their effort to increase the hiring of people with developmental disabilities. We have a really strong program in King County, both inside the government and throughout our business community. Spokane has a growing program. We're trying to, county by county, city by city, knit together a system that gets people into being able to contribute to the full extent of their ability to have a job, to earn a salary, to pay taxes, rather than being warehoused and overlooked. And it's that kind of a model where maybe we don't go directly through the state legislature, but we start working peer-to-peer across the state that may deliver us from some of these problems.
Back to Third Avenue for just a moment.
We're still talking about that.
I'm just coming back. Okay. Have you walked Third Avenue, yes?
Yeah.
What do you find troubling?
People are allowed to hang around. Remember, Mark Sidran had a big problem with trying to deal with vagrancy. But there are a lot of people just hanging around. A lot of them reside in or are there because of human services facilities, mostly down toward the south end of that Third Avenue corridor. A lot of them are there because of the buses. And, you know, in the past, there was free buses all the time. We still have free shuttles, but you could get on any bus and just kind of ride around for a while. But they're all there because something's gone wrong in their life. Either they've got an underlying challenge like mental health or addiction. They obviously have financial challenge. And we need to work on getting hold of those folks and trying to get them straightened around. Can be kind of dirty sometimes. Just a lot of people coming and going, needs more maintenance. The street environment is a little incoherent along Third Avenue. There is the need to tie it all together so that it reads better, so people understand where they are, who should be there and who shouldn't, and, you know, when their next bus is coming. It should be, with that many people coming and going, a great place to do business, a great retail corridor. And I think some of the businesses along the corridor are not finding that to be the case.
Well, it's struggled ever since the tunnel was started under construction.
Yeah. So you've got, I mean, tens of thousands of people. There are like 46,000, I think, bus trips, individual people. Their trips start or stop in that corridor, either in the tunnel or on the surface. And it's going to increase as Sound Transit gets built out, as we're able to move the buses from the tunnel to the surface. That corridor is the heart and soul of our local economy. That's where the people are coming in to make the money that pays the taxes, that keeps things running. But it also needs to be good for the local merchant. It needs to be good for the commuter. It needs to be good for everybody, and it's not right now.
Is there a corridor? You said there are transportation corridors all over the world that work. Is there one you would point us
to?
No,
because I've been careful with the taxpayer dollars. I have not traveled around to see all these corridors. But
gotten any reports?
They do bring us photos of what look like really well-functioning transit corridors, mostly in other countries, that show that you can, if you got to make some capital investment and some investment in people to manage things, you can have a really great, vibrant, exciting, and inviting transit corridor with buses. And that's what we're aiming at.
All right. All serious conversations and all serious topics we've had. So may I ask you two questions?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you are a man who loves the music.
I love music.
We looked back on some of the better live performances we had this year, and they were brought to us courtesy of your contacts and the people you listen to.
I do what I can for you.
What are you listening to right now?
The most recent thing that popped in the CD player was actually something, a CD player in a car. It was something from earlier this year. It's an album by a band called Divine Fits. And Divine Fits, I think, are some kind of super group. But they're great. And I had not listened to this. It had just been gathering dust. I had bought it because the guy at Easy Street said, hey, you ought to get this. And it was fantastic. I went to the Deck the Hall Ball. I think I was the oldest person in the building at Key Arena. And there were a whole bunch of really good bands and kids on the floor jumping up and down. I am at the other end of the spectrum, going sometime early next year after the inauguration to see The Who play in another city, because they're not coming here, which is, you know, it's like when grandpa comes to visit, you figure you ought to go see him because you don't know when it'll ever happen again. So I'm going to do that. That's an embarrassing admission that I'm making here on the air.
No, it's great. I wish I was going too. That sounds great.
Well,
all right. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
It was good to see you. We'll see you in the new year.
I'll be here.
This is Weekday. We'll be right back.
For some, it's about family. For others, it's about faith. And for some, it's just about food and drink. So what do the holidays mean to you? We'll take your phone calls at 1240 today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our listener feedback line, 206-221-3663. Tell us what the holidays mean to you. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, committed to innovative thinking, scientific breakthroughs, and saving lives. Gifts and giving play an important role in supporting life-saving cancer research. Learn more about breakthroughs at fredhutch.org.
The discovery of thousands of new oil fields, revolutionary new technologies, it's been a big year for fossil fuels.
The world is full of hydrocarbons, but the question is, at what price does it cost to produce them?
The cost to companies and consumers, and the impact on renewable sources of power. The Year in Energy, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That story and much more Sunday morning from 5 until 10 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 1040.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
The media is full of Christmas stories and tradition this time of year. Good ones and not so good ones. The golden age of radio, they had their share as well, revealed at Christmas. And they reveled in Christmas as well, didn't they?
They did indeed.
Katie Sewell's here, producer of this program, smattering of the entertainment.
Thought that I would bring you a smattering of the entertainment you would have been hearing if you were celebrating Christmas from the 1930s to the 1950s. So today on the radio, we have a lot of traditions. We have the annual KUOW or weekday Christmas party.
I'm looking forward to that.
Which is coming up.
I don't know who's invited this time, but I'm looking forward
to
folks coming.
We'll find out. And most time of year, people listen for David Sedaris telling his story of his time working as a Christmas elf.
I have spent the last several days sitting in a crowded, windowless Macy's classroom undergoing the first phases of elf training. Everything these elves say seems to have an exclamation point on the end of it. It makes one's mouth hurt to speak with such forced merriment. It embarrasses me to hear people talk this way. I think I'll be a low-key sort of elf.
For some people, Christmas just isn't Christmas unless they hear that story. Right?
Yes, yes.
And in the same way, during the Golden Age, Christmas was marked by certain entertainment that appeared every year. And one of those was the ongoing gag, heightened by Christmas, of course, the joke about how stingy Jack Benny is with his money, how he counts every penny, he doesn't want to buy gifts, he doesn't even want to fill up on gas most of the time. And so Christmas was the perfect opportunity for his miserly tendencies to be at their absolute height. And here's an example of Jack in 1938 in an episode called Jack's Christmas Open.
Hand me the rest of those ornaments. I want to get this tree decorated before the gang gets here. Now, hand me up those candy canes.
Here you are.
Hey, I had 12 of these candy canes. Now there's only 11. Where's the other one?
All right, I ate it. Here's 10 cents.
Smarty, I bet you'd be surprised if I took it.
I wouldn't be surprised if you sued me.
Should we do one more, perhaps? Here's Jack from 1936 in an episode called Old Fashioned Christmas.
Gather around, everybody. It's my turn to play Santa Claus. I got a little surprise for most all of you. Here's a little gift for you, Kenny. A beautiful red silk necktie.
Oh, thanks, Jack.
Isn't it pretty?
Gee, you know, this looks like the same tie I gave you last year.
Well, it isn't. It's different.
Yeah, it's got spots on it now. Oh, Jack.
What?
Where's the present I'm going to exchange?
Here, and don't be funny.
What is it?
What is it? Can't you see? It's an earring.
An earring?
Yeah.
One earring? Where's the other one?
Well, there'll be other Christmases, won't there?
So his miserly
character. Oh, Jack.
So perfect for the season, right? He's almost like an Ebenezer Scrooge on the radio. Everyone else is being generous, and he's being, you know, crotchety. And interesting to note, though, that we think of Jack Benny as being his penny pinching as being core to his character on this show. But that wasn't actually what they were planning to do when they were creating the show. That was an accident. During one episode, the writers wrote in a couple jokes where he was being particularly stingy. The audience had a huge response, and so they wrote in a couple more the following week, and then all of a sudden it had become a thing. And that is how he got to be that way.
Didn't I read that bothered him a little bit because he was actually a fairly generous fellow?
Yeah, it bothered him a lot, I think, as a matter of fact. He said, all of a sudden, he was quoted as saying, all of a sudden I was stingy against my will. And in every biography that you read about Jack Benny, it's noted quite severely that he was a very generous man. And don't forget that he was a very generous man, including the one that was written by his daughter. So when it comes to Bing Crosby, let's switch gears a little bit. In Christmas Nowadays, you guys were just talking about White Christmas. We think about him singing that song.
He is Der Bingle.
Right. He is White Christmas and Bing Crosby go together in our current holiday tradition. But for the radio audience back then, the song that was associated with Bing wasn't White Christmas. It was Adeus de Fidelis, which is Latin for a very...
Not your first language.
Song. No, not my first language. First song that you'll recognize, though. Here's a clip from the Bing Crosby Show in 1953.
As is Bing's custom at Christmas time, he opens the program with Adeus de Fidelis. And as usual, he'll sing it first in Latin and then in English with the studio audience joining him.
Yes, Ken, I think it would be very fitting if our guests here would join in the chorus of Come All Ye Faithful.
Bing, I think it'd be very nice if the home folks listening in all over the world would join in, too.
Oh, it would indeed. Gather around now, folks, wherever you may be, and help us sing this eternal hymn.
Adeus de fidelis, laeti triumphantes, venite, venite, in Bethlehem. Natum videte, regem angelorum, venite adoremus, venite adoremus, venite adoremus, Dominus.
That just makes me cry. The bingle. Now,
see, so that's what he would have been known for. Every year he did that.
Singing it in Latin. I mean, later they sang it in English.
Right. After that, they would usually do a sing-along in the audience and encourage everybody at home to sing along as well. But that happened every year, every single year. So moving on. Let's move on to Ebenezer Scrooge, the end, shall we?
I want to think about why you're saying that it happened every year. It's the Charlie Brown Christmas of the 50s?
Yeah, when it came to Bing Crosby, yeah.
All right.
So, we still have the tradition of watching A Christmas Carol, but in our modern Christmas culture, Scrooge is different than the character that people would have known on the radio. So, for instance, nowadays we have Scrooge McDuck from Mickey's Christmas Carol.
I'll tell you what Christmas is. It's just another work day, and any jackanapes who thinks else should be boiled in his own pudding.
And we also have George C. Scott from the 1984 television special.
If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own pudding.
George C. Scott reveled in that.
Yeah, he really did. I still think he's one of the best.
I agree.
We even had Jim Carrey as Scrooge in the latest Disney production.
Ah, humbug.
I like that.
Did you see that one?
No, I didn't.
Was there a lot of big special effects where his face would get really large?
Well, it was an animated movie.
Ah.
So it's kind of a very old, more crotchety-looking version of Jim Carrey.
I was hoping you were going to pull a clip of Mr. Magoo as Scrooge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Next year.
Next year.
Next year.
Magoo. Oh, Magoo.
But who we don't have anymore, who's missing in this, is actor Lionel Barrymore, who played Ebenezer Scrooge. He played that character every year from 1934 to 1953.
On the radio.
On the radio.
They would do A Christmas Carol, and he would be the guy.
He was the guy. Over the span of 20 years... he played Scrooge with the exception of 1935 when he let his brother John do it and 1938 when he let Orson Welles do it. But still, that's 18 different Christmases as playing one character. So if you were listening to the radio in 1930s and 40s, Lionel Barrymore was Ebenezer Scrooge to you.
That's interesting that he was Scrooge because he was Mr. Potter, right? Yes, he was Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life. That casting makes even more sense to me now because people of that era, of course, were used to him in the role of an unhappy fellow. Fellow who didn't have Christmas in his heart.
Yeah. I mean, we think of George C. Scott as being Ebenezer Scrooge, say, but people would have thought of him as being that character, which is interesting when, yeah, he is still in our Christmas tradition as that character from It's a Wonderful Life. Should we listen to a little bit of it?
Now, you take this loan here to Ernie Bishop. I happen to know the bank turned down this loan, but he comes here. And we're building him a house worth $5,000. What does that get us? A discontented, lazy rabble instead of a thrifty working class.
Doesn't make them better citizens? Doesn't make them better customers? What'd you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait, wait for what? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath?
Sentimental hogwash.
It is kind of a Scrooge-like character. So
he very much so.
He may not be our Ebenezer Scrooge anymore, but he is.
He is
in
Mr.
some
Potter.
Ways our Ebenezer Scrooge.
I think that's
Wonderful
true.
Life.
I think that's valid. By the way, don't forget that Patrick Stewart played Scrooge, too, in a modern adaptation.
Yeah, there's a lot of good modern adaptations, actually. Should we end, Steve, with one of the Northwest's most treasured radio traditions, one that we touched on a couple weeks ago?
Before you go there,
yes.
I just want to you know how I've been rankled by the cinnamon bear because it's so cloying. After listening to your piece, I still find it cloying, but better, perhaps. Especially after last night, I was kind of gearing up, and so I found this this radio play by Dickens called "The Cricket and the Hearth."
Oh yeah!
Now, if you think that Cinnamon Bear was cloying, my God, listen to that! Look that one up and listen to that, because I listening to it, I thought, are they? Is this a joke? Are they making a joke of Christmas stories with this? But of course they weren't.
No, very serious. I actually feel that way about a lot of Christmas episodes from the Golden Age.
I'm with you. Well, and The Cricket in the Hearth, I understand, was a Dickens classic and was, you know, respected. But whew, that version.
Well, I decided that we had to go out with the Cinnamon Bear, even though we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, because ever since we did that show, our producer Jason and I have been reveling in the Cinnamon Bear song and playing it at inconvenient times.
Yes, I would say.
So, since the holiday is about to be over, we thought, why not play it one more time?
I'm the cinnamon bear with the human eyes, and I'm looking for someone to take by surprise. I go prowling and growling each night after dark, but the folks say my growl's just a cinnamon bark.
Yes, the Cinnamon Bear.
Cinnamon Bear, once a Northwest favorite, as common to see in a shopping mall as Santa himself. The Cinnamon Bear, a Golden Age radio tradition.
All right. I hope that we'll keep it going. Perhaps we should mount a Cinnamon Bear reading at some point, Katie. And you can sing.
I don't know how much effort I want to put into that, but maybe. I'll think about it.
All right. And don't forget The Cricket on the Hearth, too. John Peerybingle was the main character of that. That's a good name.
All right. Tonight.
You listen to that. Katie Sewell produces this show, enjoys the Christmas traditions. This is a weekday. Sarah Dickerman, I wonder if did you enjoy that, Sarah? Were you kind of ready for a?
I'm desperately trying to think of a transition.
I have none, other than I hope that you have your favorite holiday classic. So Katie has
something
one.
With cinnamon, perhaps.
Yes.
Exactly.
Perhaps you have
there
a cinnamon.
There is probably some cinnamon in some of the stuff I will talk about.
Oh.
That's how we'll go.
Katie Sewell.
To talk about a new place to have lunch. You can have dinner there too, but a new place to have lunch on Capitol Hill called Mamnoon, which is a Middle Eastern restaurant focusing mostly on Syrian and Lebanese flavors.
Great.
Super good. And they at lunchtime, it's still just sort of partial service at lunchtime. You order at a counter and then take it to a table. I think later in the year, the new year, they'll be having full service at lunchtime. But what they serve are called mana ish, which are like a flatbread wrap sandwich type thing, a little thinner than a pita that you might think of. And it's topped with all sorts of different yummy fillings and then wrapped up and in a nice little parcel for eating.
Now, what's so, making this different from the myriad of Middle Eastern restaurants that we have? Is there something unique about their approach?
I would say there is. It's because there's a little more specificity in terms of thinking about Syrian and Lebanese flavors. And like the bread is made on site, so it's very fresh and tender bread, which is quite lovely. And I think just a little, I think sometimes restaurants are interested in delivering what people already expect from a given cuisine. And I think this restaurant's a little interested in broadening what we're tasting from that cuisine. So in this case, you can get your mana ish covered with lamb and herbs and a little bit of Aleppo pepper, which is sort of a lemony chili pepper. Or you can also get delicious melty cheese with za'atar, which is a kind of wild thyme that's just a very typical flavor. It has this wonderful, dusty, slightly minty taste that is really yummy, and then they top everything with fresh herbs and just a really satisfying little sandwich. You can get some side dishes too, a version of a tabbouleh made with quinoa, which is of course not traditional, and then some other little dips, hummus, and stuff like that. And it's really yummy.
I like the looks of their spiced chickpea cookies too. That
mm-hmm.
looks good.
Those are wonderful. I think those come from a Persian tradition. Chickpea flour is a really great, for all you gluten-free eaters, is gluten-free flour that can be made into some really nice pastries.
Sarah Dickerman is a writer about food culture. She writes for Slate, the New York Times. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. She joins us every Thursday with a lunch recommendation and a cookbook that might follow a recommendation as well. What were you thinking about that goes good with Mamnoon Restaurant?
Well, in this case, it's a very direct connection. The owners of Mamnoon brought in a consultant from Lebanon named Barbara Massad, and she has written a really fun and interesting book called Mune, which is a great present, again, for gardeners or people interested in preserving seasons. It's all about Lebanese pantry basics and using a lot of ingredients that we have here. Some we can't get, but a lot of them we can get here, but just sort of a slightly different approach to preserving flavors. That includes like drying a lot of herbs and spices and flowers. There's great pickling techniques, like for all those green cherry tomatoes we all end up with in late October because we never quite got enough sun for our green tomatoes. And those wonderful little, the origins of fruit roll-ups are actually from that part of the world. So, if you get all those Italian plums on your tree in late summer, you can make wonderful little homemade fruit leathers. And there's the technique for how to do that.
Sounds
and it's filled
like,
with photographs
sounds
of craftspeople, too.
Sounds like a nice pretty. Book.
Yeah, it's really pretty.
Very nice. All right. Sarah, again, I am hungry after those recommendations and descriptions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And happy holidays. Talk to you again.
Yes, we'll talk soon.
Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, The New York Times, other publications. Check out her work at sarahdickerman.com. We'll have links as well for Mamnoon Restaurant and for Mune by Barbara Massoud. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Sadeh, Alexander Garrettin, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our interns, Andy Hurst, our engineer. I'm Steve Scher. Talk to you tomorrow.
Good morning, it's 10:59. We'll get an update from NPR News in less than 2 minutes.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, offering short-term certificates, associate degrees, transfer programs, and career training in nanotechnology, healthcare, business, and more. Enrolling now for winter quarter classes. Information at northseattle.edu.
In Philadelphia, skip bail four times and you too may owe the city.
$41,897.70.
I'm Sarah Gardner. Cities look to recoup old debts. Next time on Marketplace from ABM.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.